Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Welcome to The Beat. I am Ari Melber, and we are tracking a fast-moving day. We begin with breaking news on the Biden agenda. Here we're tracking what you see, live pictures of the White House. President Biden is confronting what might be one of the most high-stake junctures of this first year of his tenure. As we come on the air, the president is doing something that we know about, but is also happening somewhat confidentially, a closed-door meeting with some very key House progressives. The Marine posted outside the door is what tells us in Washington speak, in the classic signals of this traditional White House, that the president remains in the West Wing. Now, this is the latest in a series of meetings that the president has been holding. Earlier today, we know that he spoke with top Democrats, Schumer and Pelosi, and met with some of those key senators who can sometimes be holdouts on so many big issues, including Sinema, Manchin and some other moderates. Now, Joe Biden is doing really what he campaigned on and something that initially hurt him among some progressives before he was the nominee. He is saying that he will be peacemaker, that he will deal with everyone, that he will work with the progressives and the centrists in this Democratic Party. Now, liberals are threatening to tank the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which the Senate passed last month, unless there is a wider agreement among Democrats on passing the broader $3.5 trillion economic and climate agenda. We believe that's some of what they're talking about there in the White House right now. The infrastructure vote is scheduled for next Monday. Now, as of tonight, there is not a full agreement on that publicly. Speaker Pelosi saying this back on Capitol Hill.
Speaker Pelosi, after your meeting with President Biden, are you still planning on holding the bipartisan infrastructure vote on Monday?
And you expect me to be, we are on schedule, let's put it that way. We are on schedule, that's all I will say.
Thank you,
Mayor. And we're calm, and everybody's good, and our work's almost done. So we're in good shape.
Good shape, on schedule, on track. That's how the speaker put it there as she moved through the Capitol bowels with her security retinue. Meanwhile, this is a make or break moment. And that's not just what sometimes happens with politicos or over-caffeinated people who follow every bit of political news. We will quote for you how the New York Times put it. Quote, no president has ever packed as much of his agenda, domestic and foreign, into a single piece of legislation regarding this spending bill because it really lays out a vision not only for what you might call Biden economics or the Biden vision for how to get out of COVID. This is money for long-term social spending, for a way to stitch together the American social contract in a new era. There is funding for childcare, for education, for paid leave, trying to deal with gender equity, and for long-term climate initiatives that remain quite controversial on the right. Will it happen or will it crumble? Some Democrats feel that if they go too far with some of this hardball, there is a scenario where they might fail to pass either spending package or infrastructure spending. Meanwhile, Senator McConnell is telling Democrats they will have to raise the debt ceiling, that there is all this concern again about whether that kind of hardball could deal an economic calamity against the United States. But they're going to have to do it, McConnell says, without any Republican help. That is, of course, a reversal from McConnell's position in the recent Trump era, which Democratic groups are quick to point out.
So you are expecting then to raise the debt ceiling once again?
Of course. We will never have America default. Well, we raised the debt ceiling because America can't default. I mean, that would be a disaster.
Republicans are united in opposition to raising the debt ceiling.
How's it go? Joker's to the left of me. Well, we'll let you finish the lyric. It is the top of the show. I want to bring in our guests, Maya Wiley and Howard Dean, both veterans of Democratic politics and a whole lot more. Good to see you both. Governor Dean, you have been in meetings like this. You ran the Democratic Party, which meant, like Joe Biden, you had to think about everyone who held a seat, not just those that you might have personally agreed with. What do you see ahead here as these meetings continue, as I emphasize, in Washington at this hour?
You know, the media can't resist the Democrats in disarray story, although, you know, they've been running it for so many years that I pass over those now. For McConnell, McConnell's got a losing hand here. Nothing happens if we pass the debt ceiling. That is, there's no political consequences that for either party. If we don't pass the debt ceiling, the Republicans are going to wear that in their elections in 2022. There will not be a Republican majority in either house if the debt ceiling doesn't pass, because the stock market will collapse, jobs will hemorrhage. McConnell knows that. McConnell is just bluffing as usual. And I wouldn't want to see this for the sake of the country, but from a political point of view, I hope he carries out his threat, because we're going to have a much bigger majority in both houses than we do today if he does that.
Yeah, you're speaking to the kind of Republican or McConnell nihilism on every bit, every type of policy, whether you're talking about the COVID issues that we've covered here, which obviously in some instances have good faith disagreement, and other instances have cynical political ploys that are leaving people sick or dead. The debt ceiling, of course, would affect a lot of people, would affect the banks and Wall Street, but it would also affect a lot of normal working people, Maya.
Yeah.
Senator Warren was talking about this. Take a listen.
What are we trying to raise the debt ceiling for now? To cover the debts that were incurred during the Trump administration. And the Republicans want to turn around and play political games with that. They want to threaten to blow up our entire economy and actually the world economy over that. They want to throw our good name in the toilet for their political gains. No.
Maya, fact check true. That is how debt works. So we're paying the bill for a lot of the, you know, the bar tab that was run up under Trump and Republican leadership. I quoted Stuck in the Middle with you with the Biden position. But this is really Stuck in the Trump with you, which is that Trump and the Republican Party were big spenders. Now the bill is due.
They were big spenders, except they weren't spending on improving the lives of the average American. And I think that's really what's at stake. And that goes back to Governor Dean's point, which is we're really talking about bread and butter issues, like whether people are going to have jobs. I mean, remember that when government shut down under Donald Trump, which was the longest shutdown we had had in the history of this country, you know, we had 800,000 just contractors who didn't get paid, who were thrown out of work, all the businesses that supported those. We have not recovered as an economy yet. We're in better shape thanks to the fact that we've been investing in the ability of American people to put food on the table. But this really is whether our politics recognizes that it's about people and not about the political position of the politician, him or herself. And Biden, as a centrist, and let's remember, he is a centrist. He has come up with a very aggressive plan to invest in people because it's the right thing to do to continue to recover, not just this economy, but frankly, a future for the country. And that's really what's at stake.
Governor?
Yeah, I think that's right. But it's the politics that interests me. I mean, for me, look, McConnell's a smart guy, but how can you really be a nihilist? His legacy is going to be, I did everything I could to stop anything from happening. I mean, what kind of a legacy is that? He's certainly no Mike Mansfield, that's for damn sure. So, or even an Ev Dirksen. He's no Ev Dirksen. I think it's ridiculous. He's not going to get away with shutting the country down. And it's a stupid thing for him to do because it's going to help the Democrats get reelected big time and throw a lot of people out. You think the people from Ohio who lose their jobs because we didn't raise the debt ceiling are going to vote for J.D. Vance or some other right-wing crackpot like Mandel? They're not. And neither are the people in North Carolina or Wisconsin or a lot of the others. Pennsylvania is another one that's a swing state. I don't think he's going to do it, and I don't think he has much choice.
Well, Howard, as always, your substance is on point. As for your sick political burns, I will say telling someone you're no Senator Dirksen, they either have to be really into politics or a historian to get that burn. But, you know, you work on it. We get more than one
Dirksen
burn.
Dirksen supported the civil rights bill. I mean, that's pretty incredible. For the Republicans used to be real people in those days.
Shout out to Senator Dirksen. Go ahead, Maya.
McConnell has decided his future is in the Supreme Court. And I think you're right, Governor Dean, about what's at stake here and that it's a bad political move. But unfortunately, McConnell has said, I've transformed the country through the courts and I've transformed it in my own image. And that's very dangerous for the country.
Right. And I think that's a fair point you're both hitting on, which is the way that he's standing against everything, standing athwart progress, is part of the legacy he wants to preserve, which brings us to another news update I have that's brand new. I want to thank Governor Dean. Dr. Dean, it's always good to see you. Maya stays with me for this one. Bipartisan police reform talks, which is something we've been covering on The Beat since their inception, and we've been skeptical about whether it was worth months and months of negotiations for Republicans if they were never going to go along. But Democrats like Cory Booker and others said give them a shot. So the news tonight, these talks have collapsed. The three lead negotiators, Congresswoman Bass, Senator Booker, and Tim Scott from the Republican Party, basically making it official, calling it quits today. A key sticking point is something we've reported on from the start, that many experts and BLM movement activists say you need to reform qualified immunity that shields police. And if you don't do that, you don't get anywhere. That was a sticking point for Republicans. Here's how Senator Booker put it.
The effort from the very beginning was to get police reform that would raise professional standards, police reform that would create a lot more transparency, and then police reform that would create accountability. And we were not able to come to agreements on those three big areas.
That is being very diplomatic. Before I bring Maya back in, I want to put our news context on this for you. It's been 485 days since a police officer murdered George Floyd. Congresswoman Bass is out with a statement calling on President Biden to step up and do the rest of this through executive orders. I bring Maya Wiley back into the conversation, a guest and expert on many of these issues, including someone who's really been at the policy level dealing with police, doing civil rights oversight of the NYPD, which you did in the de Blasio administration before running for mayor yourself. So I think viewers understand you not only care about the issue, but you understand that it's not all, of course, one snap thing. Officers have rights. So do the people they patrol. My question to you is, number one, what does it mean that reforming this bulletproof legal shield that police have that no one else has, what does it mean that that stops this cold in its tracks on substance? And two, are you concerned that Republicans played the same old game and wasted 9 months of the Biden agenda when they were never going to meet in the middle?
Yeah, look, there is no justice in this country if you can't hold police who do wrong accountable. And the major problem we've had is that people abused by the police have simply seen no justice. And when there's no justice, there's no peace. It's really that simple. And qualified immunity has been a huge barrier to getting some of that justice, to getting to go to court if the system doesn't work for you, to be able to take an officer to court and say you violated my constitutional rights. So I don't think there's any question that this is pivotal and important, you know, and whether, you know, I think fundamentally, if the Republican Party doesn't see a role for true police accountability, then we really are at an impasse. I would say it made sense to try to have those conversations because there is, as you point out, Ari, there is a real conversation about, but how do you protect against police just being paying out of their own private pocket when they're just unpopular, but they actually follow the law. But there's a way to craft that where you're transforming qualified immunity so it's not a blanket protection. That, I don't know if that conversation was happening in a real way, but unless we have that as a country, we're going to continue to see Black and brown people killed. We're going to continue to see people who are not trusting of the police, and we're going to continue to have a problem that we should be able to solve that, frankly, we all need solved.
Yeah, I appreciate your points on all that. And with regard to immunity, as you mentioned, there is nuance there, but Republicans said in public that they weren't going to budge on that. So at a certain point, if the Democrats saw that as essential, and it's in the George Floyd House version, then you have to decide when do you pick up and put on more pressure. And Joe Biden has led on many things. We were just talking about how packed his agenda is, and he's in meetings tonight. But we're going to stay on this issue because it is something that he says he cares about, that he says he ran on. Well, then it's time to continue to act on it if those things are true. Maya Wiley, on more than one topic tonight, thank you, as always.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Donald Trump going back to court. He's suing his own family and the New York Times. We have Joyce Vance here to tell you what you need to know. And that's not all. A lot more in the program tonight, developing news about January 6th riot indictments. And we have a very special guest on the roots of Republican extremism, how lies have blown up in the GOP's face. Stay with us.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Ex-president and ex-blogger Donald Trump has a range of legal problems. There's the ongoing criminal probe into the Trump Organization and its finances in New York. But now he's adding to his own caseload. He's suing his niece for allegedly $100 million, taking legal action against Mary Trump, plus the New York Times. He alleges there was a, quote, insidious plot to get at his tax records. Mary Trump providing the former president's tax documents to the New York Times for what was a Pulitzer Prize-winning explosive article all the way back in 2018 that went farther and deeper into showing how he dodges taxes and whether some of that may or may not be illegal. Today, Mary Trump says this type of thing, the insults, the suits, this is just how their family communicates.
Their way of communicating with people, they disagree with, shall we say, is to sue them. And that's exactly what they did. I guess this is how the Trump family communicates when they're not getting along.
This is how the family communicates. Now we're going to show you some of what Trump says, because you got to know it whether you agree with it or not. His allegation in the case is that there was an effort to smuggle the records out of his own files or his possession and provide them to the press. Now, Mary Trump writes in her own book that she says she had permission, which, of course, would be different than smuggling. A lawyer telling her she was actually entitled to take the documents. We should note Trump lost a legal challenge to try to prevent her book from coming out in the first place. Mary Trump also has said earlier this year that she was proud to be the source of that story.
You were ultimately the source for the tax story.
Yeah, I'm really proud of that. But I have to be honest with you, I didn't even remember I had them. So it's entirely down to the brilliant Suzanne Craig.
So that's the long history to get up to this case. Mary Trump is responding, and she's doing it in her own Trumpian way. She says that her uncle, for taking this action, is a, well, bleeping loser, and that this is desperation. The walls are closing in, and he's throwing anything against the wall that will stick. Again, the context is important. One would be forgiven to kind of tune out some of this stuff, which you can do as a news consumer. But if you have been tracking it legally, Donald Trump's entire company, his entire Trump Organization that has been the lifeblood of both his reputation, his PR, and yes, his money, has been indicted for tax crimes. The CFO's lawyer recently warned, as we reported, that more indictments could be coming. And the New York Times, responding, because it is now a defendant in this case, the lawsuit is an attempt to silence independent news organizations. We plan to vigorously defend against it. This is not a drill. It is an attack on the free press. It is also a former president doing something that, frankly, most former presidents never do, which is spend their time out of office suing journalists and family members they oppose. We're going to get into all of it. Former federal prosecutor Joyce Vance is here when we're back in just 60 seconds. Joining me now is former federal prosecutor Joyce Vance. Your views on Donald Trump's new suit against both his own family and the New York Times.
This is a curious lawsuit, Ari. You know, the word frivolous is not a word that lawyers throw around lightly about lawsuits because it has implications. Trump's Kraken lawyers learned that when they were sanctioned. But this suit borders on being frivolous. I'll just point out one instance, for instance.
As to Mary Trump and the allegations that she violated her contract with Donald Trump in disclosing these documents, the complaint fails to point to a specific provision in the agreement between them that she breached. And that's, of course, essential if you're going to prove a contract claim. There'd be no reason to withhold that in the complaint. It could even mean that the complaint would be subject to a motion to dismiss. So at least on its face, without having access to the primary documents, this doesn't look like a lawsuit that's going very far.
I kind of get what he's doing because he's done this before and he uses the courts as a kind of a theater. Trump University was a case that he lied about repeatedly. He ultimately paid millions to people that he, by paying them and you know, had signaled that he may have defrauded them, although he had a settlement that didn't technically admit fault. I get what he's doing. I get why he's doing it, and Mary Trump seems to as well with her somewhat cheeky comments. What I don't get is the when. Do you have any insight, legal or otherwise, into this coming up now?
Trump usually files lawsuits as an aggressive mechanism, right? This is his history, so he might file a lawsuit, for instance, to distract from other things that are going on around him or to try to send a message to people, maybe reminding folks that he does have non-disclosure agreements with them and that he will take to the courts to enforce them. It seems like a pretty foolish strategy, timing aside. For one thing, if it goes far enough, he'll be subjected to discovery. This is the notoriously deposition or interview shy former president who would have to ultimately sit for a deposition here. So that seems to imply that he knows that this is more of a stunt, perhaps a fundraising strategy, than it is a legitimate effort.
Yeah.
But New York has a relatively new statute, an anti-SLAPP statute, mm-hmm. that will let Mary Trump seek a fast-track dismissal of the charges and to get attorney's fees, to have them awarded to her. So it looks like a bad legal strategy for the former president.
Yeah, you're referring to some of the types of laws that try to protect First Amendment and free press freedoms, make it less onerous to defend. Before I let you go, I want all viewers and Joyce to see what our colleagues and friends Rachel and Lawrence thought about this as they did what I had to do today, which is tiptoe up to some of the words we can't say. Take a look.
And I know you reported on this lawsuit that Donald Trump has filed today.
Against
Mary Trump in the New York Times. Right above it is Mary Trump's comment. And I can't say it on TV. So it's,
you can't. So there's part of it you can't say on TV.
I don't think the Times is going to have the same comment. This, I think he is a effing loser.
Joyce, that's also a free speech claim because she could say what she wants. That's not what she's going to say in court, though, huh?
One would think that when she was first given the news of the lawsuit, there might have been a little bit of shock and surprise involved in the response. But she's certainly a straightforward, plain-spoken woman.
Respect. And diplomatically put, Counselor. Joyce, good to have you on all aspects of this story, the seriously legal and the zany. Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Ari.
Appreciate it. When we come back, we have a very special guest on the long history of lies that have blown up in the Republican Party's face. And later tonight, someone who goes all the way back to Aretha and Whitney, the music legend Clive Davis, is on the beat. Stay with us.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
We are back with Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist from The Washington Post, author and friend of the beat, George Will. His latest book, American Happiness and Its Discontents, has essays on politics and culture in a long period, including since about 2008, which overlaps with the transformation of the Republican Party as it embraced extremism, conspiracy theories, and ultimately this obsession with one person, Donald Trump. But as argued partially in the book, and as we want to point out to you tonight before we bring George in, much of this has its antecedents all the way back before Obama's presidency as it continues on to today.
I can't trust Obama. He's an Arab.
No, ma'am. He's a decent family man.
There clearly are people in America who believe in establishing euthanasia.
Government program that determines you're going to pull the plug on grandma.
There's a lot of demons around here, apparently.
Bury Obamacare with Kennedy.
You will not replace us!
Very fine people on both sides.
A total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
This election was a fraud. It was a rigged election.
60 million Americans think it was stolen.
You'll never take back our country with weakness.
A plan is now underway to use vaccine mandates to take your guns.
I hope that people will not comply by any means necessary. They shouldn't get the shot.
And George Will is here to help us. First of all, good to see you again. Thanks for coming on the beat.
Glad to be with you, and congratulations on owning 6 o'clock for all these years.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. We put the question to you as you've been thinking about it. What has happened to this modern Republican Party?
Well, it's one thing to be for limited government. It's one thing to be, as the founders were, for a government of limited, delegated, and enumerated powers. This, however, is beyond political philosophy. This is clinical psychology we have to consult. That clip you just showed is paralyzing with its sheer insanity. I don't know how you reach people like that, Ari. I just don't. Something has happened to a small group of Americans who define their happiness as the unhappiness of everybody else. They're addicted to furiousness. I actually think dopamine is released in the brain when they get angry. They're only happy when unhappy. And I don't know what you do with them besides quarantine them, try and get on with politics without them, because they're not coming back.
It's interesting you say psychologically, George, because you refer to anger, which is ancient, but I'm thinking of internet trolling, which is recent, because that's part of where it occurs, and that Donald Trump's use of Twitter and delight in the cynical angering or triggering of others as a political philosophy and priority was confessed and admitted. As you know, George, not all of the right, but some on the right, they say, we will, quote unquote, do this to trigger the liberals, meaning the goal isn't even ostensibly about government policy, or as you mentioned, limited government, but rather to anger other fellow citizens, George.
Try to imagine, Ari, a law that you could pass that would satisfy these people. We had civil rights difficulties. We said, good, Voting Rights Act, public accommodations, pass a law. I don't know how you would deal, how legislation gets wraps itself around this kind of grievance. I don't know how much of this we can blame on technology. I don't want to be a technological determinist, but the fact is, I used to believe, I'd like your opinion on this, that the quantity of stupidity relative to the size of the population was fairly constant over time. I'm not so sure anymore. Or maybe it is just that the social media gives velocity and conspicuousness to stupidity. But whatever it is, some of these people have I think they've rewired their brains in a way. They are attached in the most unhealthy way to their screens, and it's beginning to disable their ability to function in society.
I take your point, and I agree with your framework. I don't think we could be completely blaming technology or only putting it on technology. But you just said it, the velocity, the idea that what used to be up on the bathroom stall, which still spread rumors but had a real grain of salt, is now on every page. And people, when people say, well, I saw on Facebook that they're going to give out the vaccine and salad dressing, people say on Facebook like that means it was somehow credible. But depending on whose page it was, it might be the bathroom stall. And I say that by way of introduction to the last thing we wanted to ask you about, which is Michael Flynn, who exercised significant power in our government, taking that approach to conspiracy theories. Take a look.
Somebody sent me a thing this morning where they're talking about putting the vaccine into salad dressing or salads. Have you seen this?
Yes.
Have you seen this? I mean, it's, and I'm thinking to myself, This is the bizarro world, right? This is definitely the bizarro world. These people are seriously thinking about how to impose their will on us in our society. And it's
take away your freedom of choice.
For those who want to watch more of that, you'll have to go find it yourself. George, we only subjected you to 12 seconds. But your final thoughts, big picture, on where we go from here.
Well, that's exactly how conspiracy theorists think. Somebody sent me. Donald Trump's favorite locution was, they're saying. It was the antecedent was pronoun, that kind of sense of mystery by having no actual referent in the real world. You can learn a lot, I'm afraid, from the vocabulary of these people. And that was a case study in how paranoid people think. Somebody said to me, they're saying. We've heard this for years from Donald Trump, and we're going to keep hearing it, I'm afraid.
Yeah. George, thank you. And again, a shout out. Folks can check out American Happiness and Its Discontents, George Will's book, out now. Up ahead, a major challenge decades in the making with civil rights leaders calling for more action. Stay with us. Also later tonight, Clive Davis. We've got a lot coming up. There is a humanitarian crisis continuing at the U.S. border right now. Thousands of Haitians have been fleeing natural disasters and violence in their home region. It's overwhelmed a makeshift camp in Texas where there have been documented horrendous conditions, oppressive heat, and images that have stunned even the hardened. Video and pictures of Border Patrol agents on horseback aggressively corralling migrants. DHS now vows an investigation. The Border Patrol claims they have been warning the Biden administration about exactly these problems in advance. Quote, they knew this was coming, and they didn't take the steps to mitigate this. It looks like a war zone, but in the United States, some tell Politico. Now, the Biden policy has been trying to send migrants and asylum seekers back to process any requests. The issue and the problems here have certainly plagued administrations in both parties. And there has been hysteria on the right, playing up fear, pushing conspiracy theories, talking up caravans that were not near the U.S. border, and even talking about torturing children as a kind of deterrent. We lived through all that. But let's be clear tonight that heat is on the Biden administration from experts and progressive leaders. House Democrats today speaking out forcefully.
I'm pissed. I'm unhappy. And I'm not just unhappy with the cowboys. I'm happy with the administration. We are following the Trump policy. What we witness takes us back hundreds of years. What we witnessed was worse than what we witnessed in slavery.
Haitian lives are black lives. And if we truly believe that black lives matter, then we must reverse course.
Those are Democrats taking on the Biden administration. Outside of Congress, over 30 independent civil rights groups are writing to the Biden administration saying plainly responsibility for the suffering and death resulting from summary expulsions and removals falls squarely on your administration, and they must be granted legally assured chances to seek asylum. NBC News reported today that thousands will now be allowed a greater asylum process, according to at least two government officials. NBC also reported the Biden administration will seek a new contractor with guards who can speak Haitian Creole to run a migrant detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. And here is White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki today.
We're in the middle of a global pandemic, and we need to continue to administer Title 42, which expels individuals who come to the border. We can take steps to put in place a more humane, a more orderly system, especially after a very broken one over the last several years.
It is true that America's immigration systems have been broken for some time. But that is an explanation. What many people are now seeking from the president is a solution. We will stay on that story. We wanted to update you about the developments today. Now, when we come back, as promised, we have the music visionary behind Springsteen, Joplin, and Aretha, legendary music mogul Clive Davis on the beat next.
I want to thank BMG, J Records, of course, the whole team, Clive Davis.
Mr. Clive Davis.
Clive Davis.
It's my honor to pay tribute to Clive Davis.
Clive Davis, we welcome you as we induct you to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
You're talking about the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. He's made the soundtrack, you know, for our lives.
Iconic artists across many genres, all heralding one person, the music mogul Clive Davis, known as the visionary who launched Janis Joplin, Whitney Houston, Alicia Keys, and guided countless other careers from Barry Manilow to Santana. You know, we talk with many artists here on The Beat, but there's really no single living person cited more across different genres and decades than Clive Davis, who rose from humble Brooklyn beginnings to run record labels, launch his own, and really never stopped growing or innovating, which is why he seems like kind of a real-life Forrest Gump of the music industry. He was there discovering a 19-year-old Whitney Houston. He was there with Diddy to launch one of the first powerhouse rap labels back when hip-hop was dismissed as a passing fad. And he was there at the Monterey Pop Festival back in 67, discovering and then signing the great Janis Joplin, which he's telling me about in our brand-new interview airing tonight now for the first time.
Everybody there was in robes and flowers were in your hair and their hair. And here was I in khakis and a white tennis sweater, okay? I was not prepared to see new artists. I was certainly not prepared to see what was a musical revolution, not just social, not just cultural, but a music revolution. And then this charismatic, throaty, rough, fabulous voice, electrifying Janis Joplin. And I'll never forget it as I'm telling you the story. The proverbial spine tingling took place. It was really, without sounding melodramatic, an epiphany. I was seeing an artist I had never experienced before. I had never signed an artist before. I was determined to sign Big Brother and the Holding Company and Janis Joplin. And I did.
Davis, who's now Chief Creative Officer at Sony and a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, went on to sign icons like Paul Simon, Bruce Springsteen, Jennifer Hudson, while always keeping kind of the marvel and intensity of a pure fan. He recounts going to see Aretha Franklin when she was in her late 30s and wondering what else she could do in this very unfair business.
I'll never forget when I was going to her house in Los Angeles and we were going to meet for the first time, that I knew more than any other artist that I'd ever met, because she was already the queen of soul, that everything that she would do would be history. Everything that she did, sang, would be meaningful to all the generations to come. I met her when she was nearing 40, and she, as all artists, are hungry to be on top, stay on top. One of her first questions was, do you think I could have hits once I reach 40 years old? I've not had any hits in the last 2 years of my career. I said, I believe you can. And the challenge to collaborate with you will be my mission as much as any discovery of a brand new artist. It's a privilege.
Aretha went on to earn her first gold record in 7 years, Davis celebrating another hit. And he sat for this interview I'm showing you as part of our Summit series, reflecting on insights from people at the summit of their fields. Now, I was really keen to hear about Davis's work with an artist that we've actually cited in several reports on The Beat, Gil Scott-Heron.
You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
The revolution will be live. Gil Scott-Heron was years ahead of mainstream culture on everything from challenging corporate media to capitalism to racism. And in our discussion, Davis credits Heron, a singer and a poet of the 70s, as essentially the first rapper.
Gil Scott Heron was the first rap artist I was ever involved with, biting, cutting edge, dazzling in person, would not make the sacrifice to participate and broaden his musical appeal without, it was synonymous with him that it would interfere with really that word cutting edge and biting, but so talented and one of the earliest, greatest rappers ever.
Hmm. I love that idea of him as a, as the foundation of rap, because of the way he would do the spoken word poetry, and some of it rhymed and some of it just was social commentary. So I love you thinking that way, because it, every, at the edge of every genre, it blends into a new one. Genre bending, part of our conversation there. Now, some of this may admittedly sound a little obvious because it worked, and Clive Davis is buffeted by decades of success. What's more striking is to see how many times he basically managed to stay at the top by trying new things, by bringing other people along. So at a time when many executives were opposing or just didn't get new voices, whether that's Joplin or Gil Scott Heron, Davis kept his ears open. That may be why he met with a then unknown producer, Sean Puffy Combs, who played Davis music from his new artist, the Notorious B.I.G., which led Davis to spend millions of dollars helping Diddy launch his successful Bad Boy record label.
You know, he was, I think, 21 at the time. He was an executive that had worked at Uptown Records. I mean, he was not famous. I mean, he had done one or two, perhaps, concert promoting events. He came as a very young man and to the meeting. I only knew of his background, you know, characterized mainly by hip-hop music. I knew that the background of Puffy was much closer, vastly closer to the street than either I or, self-admittedly, L.A. and Babyface were. And he said, you've got to admit, not me personally, but you've got to help me get top 40 to admit hip-hop. And that was a tough order of the day. Most people never thought that rap would dominate top 40 or even be prominent in mainstream pop top 40. And but I bought into that vision. We did crossover. We did get top 40. And we were the East Coast's biggest record combination.
It's all true. And those are just some moments from this new Clive David Summer Series interview. As you can tell, those are clips because we had a much longer, deeper conversation. And I invite you to watch all of it on YouTube. Go to our Beat with Ari Twitter page. It'll be the top link. Or search Melber and Clive Davis on YouTube. There's a lot more in that interview than we were able to air tonight. He thinks in paragraphs, and I appreciate listening to all of it. We do the Summit Series for you in part to go deep. So again, I encourage you guys, if you're interested, to go check it out online or when you have time. Now, tonight here on The Beat, we also end with a programming note and a note of appreciation. Here is a headline from an outlet that covers TV news. Mediaite reporting that The Beat has just become the longest-running 6 p.m. show in the entire network history of MSNBC, which they found a newsworthy distinction. George Will made, I think, a brief reference to this earlier, which I didn't know he was going to do, but was very nice. And I'll tell you, we didn't know this would happen when we began this journey with you 4 years ago. We are grateful to you, the MSNBC and The Beat community that does support our work and watch and tune in and thus keep us on the air. We're grateful to our guests, our colleagues, and this devoted Beat team that puts on this show every night. We're also grateful to all the journalists who make MSNBC what it is, which includes a shout out to many faces you will recognize who've led this very hour over the years.
Welcome to Politics Nation. I'm Al Sharpton.
Hello and welcome to the first edition of our new program.
Now, here's Dan.
Hi, everyone.
Good evening, Americans, and welcome to The Ed Show.
The battle for the White House has entered two Florida courtrooms tonight.
Will either presidential candidate be able to bail us out of this economic mess?
There are times we all remember in politics. This will be one of them.
Many, many memorable times. Some great faces there. All of us may be aging just a little bit as we go. So again, I want to thank our team, our guests, everyone at MSNBC, and you, the viewers. We do keep you in mind. We do work hard every day trying to share with you what we think will be newsworthy, important, maybe sometimes even a little bit enlightening. I will close with a bar. What a long, strange trip it's been. And it's not even over. Thanks for watching The Beat. If you have thoughts about the past 4 years or the future, you can always find us online at Ari Melber on social media or at arimelber.com. I hope to see you tomorrow.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.